This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Yōkoso. Haere mai. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Dunedin Otaru Sister City Society podcast. I'm your host today, Nathan Woodfield, a member of the Sister City Society. I'm here today for our fifth episode. In today's episode, we'll listen to a conversation between myself and Haruko Stewart, a senior teaching fellow of the Japanese program at the university. The conversation is in two parts, and we'll listen to part one today. We'll cover a wide range of topics, including introducing ourselves, the JET program, growing up in Japan, origins of katakana words, the history and sights of Sakai City, Japanese dialects and work culture, Kumamoto City and earthquake experiences, and housing in Japan. So, without further ado, please join me in listening to part one of the conversation. Thanks. This is Nathan Woodfield here today with Haruko Stewart. Thanks so much for inviting me over today. So I really appreciate getting a chance to catch up with you again today.
Yeah, nice to see you. My name is Haruko Stewart. I teach Japanese at university in the languages and cultures at Otago University. So Nathan is in my office, a little bit messy room, right before our midterm break and midterm tests and everything.
Lots of marking.
Yeah, a lot of marking and a lot of handouts and everything. Yeah. Yeah, it's so messy. So, yeah, good that it's a radio, not TV.
we'll take a photo.
Don't do that.
In a location of your choosing.
No, I don't want every lecturer is like this. It's just only me. So, yeah.
But I guess it's like once you finish one test, the next one's rolling around the corner.
Exactly. So this is permanently messy like this. Yeah. Oh, no, maybe just my room. I don't know.
Maybe I'll have the answers in here for the students.
I know. Don't look at anything.
Yeah. It's a JEPA 132 midterm test.
Exactly. We've just finished this today, this morning, at 9 o'clock.
I hope
poor them.
Yes. Yeah.
Some of them looked very sleepy. I feel for them. But, you know, I mean, we have to do that. So we did that. I'm sure they studied very hard, so they did very well. I hope so. And so, yeah, so we are in my office, and it's called the Burns Building on Albany Street, across from the OUSA, across from Veggie Boys, right next to the Central Library. Nice. And we can see the Otago Bay, Inlet Bay.
The harbor there.
And harbor and peninsula. It's beautiful. It's a sunny day today. We know each other. We have known each other for a long time.
Yes.
And Nathan was my lovely, lovely, nice student before. When was that? Was it 2010?
Yes. So I graduated high school in 2010. So I would have started university in 2011.
Yeah, okay. A long time ago.
Right? You know, it sort of feels like, oh, it was just a couple of years ago, right? But it's like, oh.
I know.
That's more than a decade ago now.
Yeah, so. But you could pass as like, you know, maybe second year student at Otago University. I didn't say maybe first year. Okay. You look mature, more mature than that. But yeah. Easily as a second year student, I think you could pass.
No longer a fresher, as they say at the university.
Well, you look mature.
Yeah.
But yeah, what do you think? I mean, you've been here like many times when you were... Yeah, because you were our student.
Yeah, yeah. It was a lot of fun sort of walking through the university campus again. I mean, I think a lot of the core buildings are still the same, but
yeah.
You know, they've sort of updated some of the paths.
Uh-huh.
A few years ago, they sort of upgraded sort of the riverside.
That's right, because it was always like, what, there was flood, you know, whenever we had a lot of rain, big rain. I mean, always was flooded. Yeah, yes. So they had to fix it, right?
And always when it floods, there'll be the students that get out on their surfboards as well.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very kiwi. I love it. Yeah. Maybe I can't see that kind of thing in Japan, but here, definitely, I like it. I like it. That's what I love about New Zealand.
Yeah.
We can do anything.
It's great to be able to come back to the Burns Building.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I certainly spent quite a bit of time here.
Yes, this is your... You know, you are building.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I know you did major in Japanese. So what else did you study?
Yeah,
In 2011.
The major was language and linguistics.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you went there to Japan to teach English, right?
Yeah, that's right. Headed off to Kumamoto.
Yes.
On the JET program.
Everybody wants to get the JET program.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a great sort of structured way to go to Japan as well. And, you know, I think it sets a lot of direction in going to Japan as well.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You don't have to worry about sort of organizing visa paperwork or sometimes I'm reading posts online about people leaving Japan and then having to sort out the pension refund paperwork. But if you're going there privately, you need to actually organize someone privately to.
Oh my God. Japanese bureaucratic things. You have to go through a lot, right? Yeah.
A lot of paper based stuff. And, you know, I'm good at Japanese, but.
Yes, you are.
You have to be.
I have to tell the audience, I mean, the listener, not the audience, the listener. I'm not on TV. Yeah, that's right. That's why I'm not showing my messy room. Yes. So, yeah, I mean, we had to tell the listener. Yeah. So Nathan's Japanese is very good. Very, very good. Yeah. So maybe you can show it off after talking about something.
Yeah.
Maybe in 5 minutes, maybe you can show your Japanese. It's really good. Yeah. Because you were in Japan, like when you were little, right?
That's right. Yeah. So I essentially grew up in Japan. Yeah. I was born in New Zealand, but went.
You're from Dunedin.
Yeah.
Dunedin, right?
Yeah. So my parents were already actually working in Japan.
Right.
As
an English teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just thinking back to, say, the 90s, you know, getting around in English, especially the medical system, wouldn't have been as easy. I mean, Japanese doctors do learn a second language, but maybe not to the point that you are sort of having a sufficient conversation to understand what's
happening. Yeah, I know
what
you mean.
Patient perspective. So,
yeah, they know a lot of big terms, like, you know, about symptoms and everything.
Yeah.
And illness names and everything.
They might be quite good at Latin words.
I know. Yeah, a long time ago, even German words, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Like karute for a patient card. And Rentogen for an x-ray.
Right.
And,
yes, because the Japanese katakana, you think, oh, it's going to be English, but no, it's actually often other European
exactly Portuguese words because of the, you know, 16th century missionaries.
Yes,
a lot of Portuguese words like castera, like a kind of sponge, eggy sponge cake, and tempura. Even tempura, I mean, it was from Portugal, right?
And bread is pan, which is as opposed to bread, which would be like bredo.
So a lot of German words too, like ryukusaku, ryuku. And arubaito. And some, fewer, but still some French words as well.
Yeah.
French words, like, I mean, you don't want to use this word now because, you know, young people will laugh at you, but maybe my mother's generation, like rendezvous, like a date. But it's a long time ago. Even I didn't, in my generation, even I didn't use that. So please don't think, oh, Haruko taught me rendezvous. So please don't use that in Japan.
Yeah.
I mean, they will wonder what kind of teacher is she?
Right.
I mean, ooh, what era, I mean, does she come from? So maybe I shouldn't. But we used to use that a long time ago. So it's a lot of, you know, foreign words.
So they came back to New Zealand just for me to be born.
Yeah.
And then sort of
to be born.
Rest and recover, catch up with family, and then headed back. So then I lived there till I was about 10.
Yeah. So in total, how many years did you live there when you were little?
I mean, I came back on a few summer holidays just to visit family and so forth. But other than summer holidays, I was there till I was 10.
Wow, so you are, I mean, you were a Japanese kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shogaku yonensei, so that'll be primary school grade 4. But in Japan, you start at 6 years old as opposed to 5 in New Zealand.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So how did you find it? Like, you know, Japanese school, I mean.
Yeah.
It was primary school.
A lot of fun because, you know, one of the first questions I get is, you know, did I go to English school? Well, no, I just went to the local
public school. In Sakai City?
Sakai City,
In Osaka?
Folder here today, which...
beautiful.
Yeah, Sakai City. In Osaka Prefecture, it's a portside city, but it does have quite a long and sort of ancient history for
Japan. That's right, Sakai City,
well.
Yeah.
So I think...
Like a merchant city, right?
Yeah. What I really enjoyed living in Sakai too is that in primary school, they really teach you a lot about the local history.
Wow.
So I think I always thought everyone in Japan knows this, but as an adult, I'm kind of starting to realize, it's just...
Yeah, you are a Sakai otaku. You've got a lot of information. I wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, tell me more about Sakai City then. So it's a merchant city.
Yeah.
So, and what else?
Well, the Sakai propaganda, as it were, to our local kids was, in sort of modern history... It was a merchant city, a manufacturing hub.
Yeah.
And they were great at metallurgy. So they produced a lot of muskets.
Wow.
In the early days.
Really? You see, I don't know. You know it. Wow. So your teachers at primary school teach you these things.
Yeah, in class.
It's a good school. I wish my school was like that.
That's right. So not as much about your local.
No, I'm from Yokohama, but I don't remember, I mean, that my teachers taught me like that.
Right.
Maybe I was not listening, I was talking, but... But yeah, I don't remember. I can't remember that.
I feel like Osaka people are very proud of their local area.
I think so.
Yeah,
because that's what I love about Osaka people. Because, you know, some regional people don't really feel... How can I say? I think they feel a little bit embarrassed about using their dialects.
Yes.
Which they shouldn't.
Yeah.
But they think, oh, maybe people will think I'm from a countryside. Maybe they will laugh at me. So they kind of change it to a so-called standard, like Tokyo kind of dialect, right? And then always I really admire Osaka people because they keep it wherever they go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. you know, going to Kumamoto, because I mean, as a tourist, obviously I'd traveled around other parts of Japan, but I only really noticed it once I lived in another city. People would apologize to me for speaking Kumamoto dialect. And, you know, I had a lady, a very old lady, come up to me in perfect English and say, "Oh, you know, sorry for, you know, my terrible Japanese."
Oh, no, be proud of that.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I mean by, like, I love Osaka people. I mean it. I know, like, you know, Tokyo people and, you know, Osaka people are a little bit rivals. And you know, they say something a little bit bad about each other. Just like we say, well, I don't, but you say, like, about, I don't know, Aucklanders.
Yes, you know.
I mean, it's a very cute rivalry thing. I mean, it's not a rival like an enemy foe kind of thing. It's friendly, but still rivals.
But like, say, Australia and New Zealand.
That's right.
We poke fun at each other, but it's sort of a brothers fighting.
Yeah, inside we love each other, but you know, they say, like, oh, Tokyoites, you know, they're snobbish and you know, and then Osaka people, they're a little, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say that, but like something, you know, not so positive. But I mean, we love each other.
Yeah.
And actually, you know what? I was born in Osaka.
Oh, there you go. So you're secretly a native.
I know.
Well.
I was just born and I just inhaled the air there. And so, and then people think, whenever I actually meet new people, they think, you must be from Osaka. But I was just born, so I cannot remember anything.
Oh, maybe the air had an influence.
Exactly. The water there, maybe. Yeah. So I was born in Osaka. Yeah. So my parents really loved it there. It was because of my father's business, business, right? He was transferred to a branch office in Osaka. And he stayed there. We stayed there like for 3 years, four years.
Okay, so
I was really born, so I cannot really... Well, maybe 2 years. No, I don't know. I cannot remember because I cannot remember anything. So it must be very short. And we came back to Yokohama. So it was a very short time. But my parents really still keep telling me they really loved the days in Osaka at that time.
Wow.
That's really because even special. To a department store, you can just kind of, you know, wear just, I don't know, somewhere or something like a kind of like a working people's kind of casual kimono, cotton kimono, and with sandals, and you can just go to a department store. Maybe not now, but at that time, casually. So they really told me they're very frank, relaxed, interesting, and very laid back, and just really frank. Just kind of be themselves. Really liked it. They really talked about them so much, and I thought, okay, I should go back there when I become an adult.
Did you have to transfer a few times? Because I did notice in Japan people sort of transfer between cities quite a bit, maybe compared to
New Zealand. And in many companies, they sell just, you know, the husbands and the families have to kind of stay in their hometowns. But luckily, I think in my father's case, we were able to go there. Well, I was not there. I was born in Osaka, but from Yokohama, we were able to go there as a family. So he was lucky, but as you know, like Tanshin Funi, like just a solo kind of business, kind of living in another place, like by yourself and your families are back in your hometowns, but you just have to kind of live there and work for 3 to 5 years. That was normal at that time.
Because
companies don't want to pay for your family's expenditure and everything. So just by yourself, you have to go there. But in some cases, like my father, families could go there. But
Do people that do that typically commute home in the week? weekend on the Shinkansen or something? Is that what they do? They sort of wait for
if they live them by themselves, right? Yes, yeah. They do. That's what they did.
Right.
Yeah. These days, maybe with families because, you know, the time has changed.
Yes.
But at that time, for as you know, for the rapid economic growth.
Right.
Yeah. And that time, Kodo Keizai Seicho time. In my father's generation, a lot of people had to go there by themselves, even to foreign countries sometimes.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. So it must be very hard.
Yeah. This is a family like that. So it's really special that you got to follow that because
yeah,
I feel like both you and your dad would have missed out on a lot of that time.
I mean, lucky to be born in Osaka.
Yeah.
Like I remember Yodogawa River and those places. Yes. Yeah. You know that, right?
Yeah. Much time spent.
I mean, at that time they couldn't tell whether it was the baby was a boy or a girl, and yeah, they thought I was a boy because I was kicking inside in my mother's tummy and everything. So yeah. Yes. Must be a boy.
Strong and healthy.
Yeah, we've got a daughter already, so a boy, but no, it was a girl.
Two girls, yeah.
Yeah, but I want to go back there. I think I've gone back there once, but just for a short time. I mean, just for a few hours, maybe. Yeah. I think I should go back there. What do you recommend?
Well, I mean, I just have a picture here of Sakai, sort of looking over the cityscape, and one of the things I have there is the Daisen, the Nintoku
Tenryo.
They call it like a tumulus cluster. Like there's many of these sort of raised mound tombs.
Mm.
I suppose the most famous tomb in the world would be, say, the pyramid. In a pyramid shape.
Yeah.
But this is sort of like a...
That's very beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of a keyhole shape that's actually raised in a mound with a moat surrounding it, which I suppose sort of protects the tomb.
Yeah.
And the biggest one, the moat is still there, whereas I suppose there were other sort of royalty at the time.
Yeah.
You know, sort of in the... I think it's in the 400 to 700s ish.
It's the most famous one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the biggest one, like you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a really big park next to that. So I think that one was called Daisen Koen. I could be wrong. Next to the big tumulus cluster there. So I'd often go there. And we'd be very familiar with the tomb there because it was right next to the big playground.
Wow. Well, it is huge. I mean, I can see a lot of high rises, but they look so small. So that must be so huge.
Yeah. You know, the length is well over 100 meters. It's quite a long walk to walk around the moat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Do you want me to go? I mean, you know, if I go there, I have to go there.
Yeah. And in terms of, I suppose, shopping, they talk about Japanese knives made in Sakai.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, after all, it's a samurai country, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I think...
So they make good ones.
Yeah. That's what they're saying.
Yeah, Sakai is famous for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I mean, when we talk about Osaka, always kind of Sakai City pops up.
Oh, wow. Mm. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Right next to the port. So
have you got your My Knife? We say My Knife, My Nantoka, something.
Yeah. I've picked up a couple
My own
there.
Something.
I've left it at my parents' house, a Japanese knife from Sakai, and I do have a couple of others at home as well. And I actually met a Japanese knife dealer in Dunedin.
In Dunedin?
In Dunedin, yeah.
What?
So, yeah, right.
What?
Yeah, must be the southernmost.
In Dunedin, not in Auckland? In Dunedin? Yeah. Wow.
So a business called With Knives. And it's located just next to George Street.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, I want to visit there.
Yeah, well worth checking it out. And when I went to visit him, he had Sakai knives there as well, which I was very happy to see.
Nice. Yeah. Wow.
So if in Dunedin you want to buy a Sakai-made knife, you can
check
out the website.
Very good.
Yeah, withknives.com.
You should become an ambassador for the Sakai City.
I mean,
you were saying so many good things about Sakai City. I mean, without them asking you, you are really good. Have you lived in other places in Osaka or just only in Sakai City?
Just in Sakai City. Mm. I think my parents had lived in outside of Sakai, but in Osaka, in a period before I was born or that I don't remember.
Mm.
But all my life that I remember, I was in Sakai City.
Great. Yeah. Well, I mean, I would like to move on to the topic about Kumamoto because I'm interested in that as well.
Yeah.
So totally a different place.
Yes.
Yeah. How was it?
Yeah. So I lived in the old city, as they called it, which was right next to the castle walls.
That's right.
Yeah. As a Hurumachi, I think. It could have been a slightly different name in my exact suburb, but it was literally next to the castle walls. So that was quite a striking
feature must be.
of the neighborhood, literally one block away.
Wow.
There. Yeah.
It's like your garden.
Yeah.
I mean, just right there.
So it was quite a change from living in Sakai, because when I lived in Sakai, I was sort of on the intersection of 2 8-lane motorways.
Wow.
Which had a raised 4-lane motorway on top. So there were, eight, 16, 20 lanes worth of roads just next to me.
I'm not good at those things, you know, even with a navigator.
Right.
I always get lost because, I mean, so many lanes. So when the navigator tells you, oh, migi desu, migi ni magatte kudasai, turn right. But,
off the 4 lanes.
I know. I mean, so many cars next to you, so it's too late. So, yeah, you had to go around and around and around and come back again. Driving a car in Japan, it's not my cup of tea.
The traffic jams can be pretty bad.
I know. So here people say, oh, it's a traffic jam, like near the station, Dunedin station. No, it's not.
You're not waiting more than a few seconds.
Exactly.
So
you were living right next to the castle Kumamoto-jo.
Yeah, so a bit more nature, I thought. And, it's partly on the location, I suppose. I'm sure other locations felt a bit more industrial in Kumamoto, because there certainly are factories there too.
Mm-hmm.
But I really did appreciate that sort of immediate change in scene.
Yeah.
Probably one of the significant events living in Kumamoto was I was there during the big earthquake that
happened. That's right. I was about to ask you about that.
So, immediately after it happened, the closest evacuation school for me was a school that was also literally next to the castle wall. So you could see massive parts of the castle wall that had actually crumbled.
Scary.
The castle falling.
Yeah.
So that was something I saw, well before sort of maybe it was in the media with those big photos that came out the morning after. Because the earthquake was at night.
That's right.
Because, I suppose there were two big shakes, actually.
Yeah.
There was sort of that foreshock and aftershock, which was turned out to be the main shock.
Oh, my God. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm used to earthquakes as a Japanese person, but not that big one. Was it like magnitude like 6, 7?
I think it was around a 7 or so, which is...
Oh, my God.
I never really had experienced an earthquake before, even having lived in Japan.
That's right.
10 years. Partly in the shadow of the Hanshin earthquake? The one in Kobe? What was that one?
Yeah.
Because growing up in Japan, at school, they always told us about the Hanshin earthquake. Because in the Japanese public school, you have yearly, if not twice yearly, earthquake drills.
Oh, yes. We've got to, right?
Yeah. Mm. And they tell you how to hide under the...
With the helmet on. And
helmet.
And where to go.
Where to go.
Yeah.
And...
What to do, what not to do.
Yeah.
Where to hide yourselves. Like, obviously, the toilets are toilets are the best. I don't know. As long as you keep the door open.
Right.
Otherwise, you'll be just stuck.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Locked and stuck and everything. But I mean, I don't know. If it's a big one like that, I mean, nowhere is safe, I think.
Yeah.
Right? Has to be maybe in a big pillar, big, strong, durable building. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I suppose, because I suppose Japan wants to, you know, on one level, protect the children the most. Mm-hmm. So the schools in Japan, you know, they look like a bit of a brutalist architecture most of the time. Very sort of square buildings.
Yeah.
It's a very specific design because it has to be very earthquake safe.
Yeah.
So their schools double as an evacuation center. So,
For the community as well.
Yeah. So some of the schools are obviously a bit older, and I think it's the buildings built after 1980s were built to an even safer standard.
Yeah.
So fortunately, the apartment building I was living in was built after the Hanshin earthquake.
Oh, good.
And it was a bit safer, whereas one of my colleagues in Japan, it was only about 5 years older.
Yeah.
Not a big difference, but it was built to a different building code.
Uh-huh.
So all the wall tiles were crumbling, and you could see cracks through the building.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh. So, I mean, you were inside your apartment, right?
Yeah. So, I was,
so
the
how
first
did
one
you
I was sleeping.
Feel?
And actually, the second one I was sleeping too.
Oh, my God.
You know, initially, I just sort of woke up and was like, oh.
Again, another one.
It's just like a bit rolling, you know? And then you're like, is this an earthquake, you know?
Or is it my dream?
Because it kept on shaking for quite a long time. Ooh. And it just got more and more intense until things started falling and shaking violently. So it's kind of funny that there's like sometimes a bit of a gentle start.
Yeah.
And it just builds up and up and up in intensity. And it's like, okay, gosh, I better get out and chicken on my friends. And so we quickly messaged each other and knocked on people's doors to make sure they're okay.
Yeah,
and,
that's great.
It was kind of a community of the apartment people sort of gathered outside.
Mm.
And odd enough, it's probably the second time we'd done that because there had been a fire alarm that went off, false alarm.
Yeah.
So we're a wee bit familiar with, hey, who lives here?
Yeah.
And we sort of walked as a group towards the closest school, but that must have been a bit old, and an engineer had decided not safe enough, so we went to the next school. And that one was packed. A lot of people there. And not on the first day, because it was overnight when it happened, but in the days after that, the army came in and set up tents in the school ground as well for people to sleep in. And we slept in the gymnasium on the floor.
Oh, really? And food was given and provided and everything.
Yes. Uh-huh. So I think
water.
The schools have a good supply for about 3 days, though I think maybe the school was a touch overwhelmed because more people ended up there than planned, because more schools than expected were sort of damaged beyond use. So we stayed there for 3 days and then sort of left. And that's when the third quake hit. I think just as everyone went home, it's like, oh, it's all over now.
Yeah.
Let's go home.
Well, you
and
never know, right? I mean, it just keeps going.
Yeah.
I mean, you must be really scared.
Yeah. And after the second quake, I think that's when things got stressed a bit more, because buildings that have been damaged were damaged further. And the food and water supply had been actually used up mostly from the first quake. So it was actually quite hard to get more resources in. You know, maybe they helicoptered some stuff, and I presume, but a lot of the motorways were closed. The train lines were obviously closed as well.
So, of course, your classes were cancelled for a while.
Oh, there's no transport to them. But I think we got a message, just help out at your local closest school if you can. Uh-huh. There wasn't really much we could do, but I think we tried to make ourselves a touch useful because there were a lot of elderly residents. So they'd do a few exercises each day, and we spent quite a bit of time trying to find where water was for the day, because there'll be a water truck, so you could bicycle out to the water truck, get some water, take it back and share that around. And
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, it's not a good experience, and I'm and still the recovery is still keeping going, and I really want to, you know, express my sincere sympathy, you know, towards the Kumamoto people.
The people in Kumamoto, you know, it did affect a lot of people quite deeply. I mean, obviously,
of there were
some people that lost their lives in the from the quake, or sometimes in the, you know, events related to
of
the
course,
quake. But it did upend, I think, a lot of people's lives, be it jobs or schooling. Maybe a bit similar to what happened in Christchurch, you know, people have to go to a different school now. Or one of the families I knew, they ended up going to another city, almost as a bit of a sort of a Kumamoto City refugee, I suppose, going to another city for about 2 years before, while the house was fixed and so forth.
So, I mean, Japan and New Zealand are like similar in that sense. Like, they're both very beautiful, like, you know, volcanoes, you know, dormant, you know, volcanoes, and, you know, and sometimes something could be active. But, like, I mean, that make those things make New Zealand and Japan very beautiful. I mean, landscape scenery wise, but it could be very dangerous, of course. So we have to really, we live like next to, you know, kind of danger. So we have to really be careful and help each other and everything. So that terrible, scary experience must have made you think, like, maybe something about your life or about your future, or
I mean, certainly it's a big lesson in terms of disaster preparedness as well. And you know, Dunedin is largely a remnant of a volcano. And I suppose other places are a bit more active, but maybe one of the big ones that people talk about is Alpine Fault. Again, those beautiful mountains, Mount Cook, the Southern Alps.
The fault line. It's fortunate that we've got this kind of theme, but they could be dangerous, right?
So, I mean, I think for me, maybe like a perspective.
You
know, I think Japan embraces sort of the impermanence off a lot of things, right? Like, you know, buildings are considered an impermanent object on the landscape, whereas I think New Zealand still has a bit of that sort of inherited European thought that buildings are here sort of forever, you know? Probably partly inspired by, you know, like Rome. It's like, oh, here's a 2,000-year-old building. You know, we'll build a 2,000-year-old building. This building will be here forever. Great, 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 great grandchildren see this. But in Japan, you know, buildings are like here. And it might be gone in 30 years. It might be a different cityscape.
Yeah, because as you know, it's changing now. But like Japanese people tend to buy their own houses. I mean, build their own houses. And I don't know. I mean, even if, in my neighborhood, in my hometown, right? There was a very beautiful new modern house. And then that owner had to leave. I don't know why, but they had to leave. And then it was like, what, like just 3 years old. The house was just 3 years old. But the next person came and they just destroyed it. In 3 years. I'm not exaggerating this. In 3 years, it was such a perfect new house. But they had to destroy it, and they had to build their own, like, you know, house. Interiors, you know, exteriors, everything are like, everything is like what they want.
Okay.
Because as you know, in Japan, once you buy a house, it's your permanent house.
Yeah.
Yeah, in your lifetime. Maybe you've got kids, so you want to move to another bigger house. And then kids became a second hand house. Yeah.
So we don't really think of things in a second hand house.
Yeah.
But in Japan, it's got a terminology for that, right?
Like 中古住宅.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
Which is, no one really quite thinks like that in
New Zealand. Common here to buy a secondhand house, so we don't have to say it's a secondhand house. There are some very rich people who can build their own houses, but normally we do buy a secondhand house, which is perfectly all right. I mean it's so beautiful, and I love those houses, but because Japanese people want to build their own houses, that's what happened to my neighborhood. And I was like, don't destroy that. It's so beautiful. Yeah. Can I live there? Well, I couldn't afford that. But
but a bit extreme, isn't it? Yeah, because it's almost like everything's tied up in the land value alone.
Yes.
In Japan.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Land is very expensive. But I mean, your house, your second house doesn't cost anything, right? But that's what I love, again, about New Zealand, because even if your house is like, was built in 1950s, 60s, but the value still goes up.
Right.
As long as you maintain that and maybe you renovate it and improve it. It still costs a lot. I mean, if it's in a nice area, right?
Yeah.
Especially.
Because Dunedin's certainly not a old city compared to many places in the world, but I suppose for New Zealand standards, we have many older buildings.
Yeah. You know,
heritage is sort of, heritage architecture is one of Dunedin's maybe selling points, like sort of incense and knifeware and the tombs of Osakaya, sort of heritage and literature are sort of the selling points of Dunedin.
That's what I love about Dunedin, because I feel like I'm in Europe as well. So, I mean, I love New Zealand so much, I mean, best. And then I love European countries too. So I feel like I've got like two birds by one stone, like, you know, maybe three birds, four birds, because I feel like living in Europe as well.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, this Dunedin looks like, Edinburgh, right?
Yes. Dunedin, the very town name is, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so people say, I mean, who have been to Edinburgh told me that it looks like Dunedin.
Right, a lot of the street names are the same in the original parts of it.
And it does look like Otaru as well, our sister city society.
Yeah.
It does. I mean, because really I can say this because I've been to Otaru.
Yes. So, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. I always enjoy catching up with Haruko, and it was a lot of fun covering the many topics. We'll have part two of the conversation in our next episode. For upcoming events, the university will be hosting a cherry blossom viewing, a hanami. This will be weather dependent, but it is aiming for Wednesday the 10th of September. Updates will be posted on the Languages and Cultures at the University of Otago Facebook page. We'll, of course, share this on the Society's page and email newsletter as well. This is a very special occasion to see the beautiful trees in front of the clock tower and mark the changes of the season. The Society will have its AGM coming up as well. The specific date will be confirmed soon and shared on our Facebook page and email newsletter, but we're looking at holding it in October. Looking out further, there will of course be our annual Sajinshki, the coming of age ceremony, and this will be in January. More details to come, so thanks so much. From here, to follow the Society and hear about our upcoming events, you can follow us on Facebook if you search for the Dunedin Otaru Sister City Society. Otaru is spelled O-T-A-R-U. We also have an email newsletter that you can sign up to. You can message a page on Facebook or email me directly at dunedinotarupodcast@gmail.com to sign up. This show is played on Otago Access Radio in Dunedin on the airwaves of 105.4 FM and 1575 AM. And it's also on its website, oar.org.nz. You can also listen to us online through your favourite podcast app, including Spotify and Apple Podcast. Just search for the Dunedin Otaru Sister City Society podcast. That's Otaru spelled O-T-A-R-U. Thanks so much for listening and joining us today. O kiki itadaki. Arigatou gozaimashita. Till next time, mata ne.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.